The Triathlon Show 333. Up, everybody, welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Dr. Andy King. Andy is an exercise physiologist at the Australian Catholic University, and he joins us today to discuss the science and application of hydrogel products, for example the likes of Morton and SIS Beta Fuel. Do they work? How do they work? And is it worth paying the premium compared to regular sports nutrition products? Those are questions we'll try to answer in this interview. But before that, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. Precision Fuel and Hydration have two new and exciting products that I want to highlight today. First, they have the PF90 gel, which is affectionately known as a jumbo gel. It has 90 grams of carbohydrate in it and a resealable cap, so it's a great product for carrying efficiency, because having even one or just a couple of these gels can go a pretty long way even on your longer workouts. The other new product is the PF30 Chew, which you can get in two flavors, either the original, which is a mild and neutral flavor, or in a mint and lemon flavor. These chews are great alternatives to gels or sport drinks, especially during longer workouts at lower intensities, because they can feel a bit more satiating and satisfying than the alternative. Each chew package contains 30 grams of carbohydrate, as the name implies, because as always with precision fuel products, one of the main objectives is that it should be easy for you to hit your target numbers. So all products are 30 grams of carbohydrate or multiples of 30 grams, as in the case of the PF90, which is just similar to three PF30 products. As a listener of the show, you can get 15% off your first order of fueling and hydration products by using the code TTS22 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Zenate. The Zenate Indoor Swim Trainer is a swim training tool that you can use at home, allowing you to improve your technique, work on power and stamina, and save time and stay consistent. Consistency is the most important thing in training, but sometimes it's tough to find the time to get to the pool, so to have a time-efficient way to complement your pool and open water swimming at home is invaluable. In addition, you can use it to do things like swim, bike, brick workouts, and you can work on your core activation and streamline with the help of the built-in instability element of the swim bench. The Zenate Swim Trainer does not take up a lot of space, and it is very affordable, even more so with a 20% discount code that you can get on zenateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Also, it's a risk-free investment. If you don't love it after 2 weeks of using it, send it back and you can get a full refund. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Dr. Andy King. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Andy. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me along.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. Can you start by introducing yourself and tell us a bit more about your background?
Yeah, my name's Andy King. I'm a researcher in exercise physiology and human metabolism. Currently work at Australian Catholic University, having moved from Leeds in the UK a few years ago. And most of my interest lies in endurance sport and how we can optimize performance through physiology and nutrition manipulation.
Yeah, and the reason that I found out about your work is some papers that you and your colleagues have published around hydrogels, which is in the last few years have been becoming more prominent on the in the marketplace and also in the literature. So that's one of the main things we'll talk about today. And can we start by, can you explain to us what are hydrogels really? How do they differ from regular gels?
Yeah, it's a new product, like you say, that's made its way onto the market over the last kind of 4 or 5 years and gained in a lot of popularity through what was initially some pretty good marketing and a really good relationship with a lot of high-level professional endurance athletes. And the product is effectively the same as what you would expect to see in a typical carbohydrate drink or gel, as in it's sugar. Delivered in solution to the person exercising. But the hydrogel uses the addition of a couple of extra ingredients. One of those ingredients is alginate, which is a polymer derived from seaweed. And one of those other ingredients is pectin, which is a similar biopolymer polysaccharide, which with that unique combination with alginate in the hydrogel allows the whole ingested solution to form a kind of gel-like substance once it comes into contact with the extremely low pH environment in the stomach. And the idea is that then that gel moves kind of unimpeded into the intestine, where it can be accessed by the enzymes in the gut, in the intestine, to facilitate that transport of carbohydrate that then we would typically see with a normal carbohydrate solution or gel.
So the benefits of that would be that it comes into the intestine more rapidly than regular gels. So is it also possibly about just not running the risk of having the stomach not being able to do gastric emptying as quickly and potentially having stomach upset because you have too many gels, normal gels that don't move out into the intestine quickly enough? Or are there any other benefits of this structure?
Yeah, so it's a kind of question that sounds quite easy to answer, but there's a bit of kind of complex physiology that goes behind it. I won't sort of get too much into the depths of that, but when you drink a solution that contains carbohydrate, typically that will delay or slow down gastric emptying. And that happens sort of to a point of osmolality where the content or the total carbohydrate content will start to slow that down. The idea with the hydrogel is that the gel allows the carbohydrate to just move through the stomach without that feedback effect happening, and gastric emptying thereby isn't delayed. So once you get over that kind of osmolality threshold that typically would slow the gastric emptying, the idea is that the hydrogel will effectively hide the carbohydrate content and allow that to not delay gastric emptying. There's a kind of balance that's got to be struck here between the amount of fluid that someone can drink and the gastric emptying that's going to be required to deliver the drink and its contents, and also the amount of carbohydrate that we want to get through. So even though gastric emptying does slow once we get to a certain point of concentration of carbohydrate, we actually can still deliver more carbohydrate, even though gastric emptying is slightly slowed down, if you're with me. So there's a kind of sweet spot for the carbohydrate content. And the idea, certainly with the hydrogel, is to try and hide or smuggle more carbohydrate in.
Mm, yeah, no, that's a great explanation. And I just realized that for listeners that may not be familiar with the term hydrogel, maybe we should just name a couple of examples. So Morton, I guess, is probably the original, unless I'm mistaken. That's one of the big brands anyway, but now there are other brands like Science in Sport, Beta Fuel, I think, uses a similar methodology, and there might be others as well, just to set the context for the listeners.
Yeah, Morton's certainly the primary driver in the marketplace. Beta Fuel, like you say, is an alternative product. Morton were the key movers in getting this into the sports nutrition world, and they certainly pushed it and marketed it very well, and they've got a huge amount of support from athletes from very early days. And that support isn't just, I think, pure marketing. That's anecdotal feedback from athletes to say that they did feel a benefit from the product.
Yeah, and that leads us to then, over the last few years, scientific studies have started to try to evaluate systematically how these gels really work in terms of things like performance and GI symptoms and more. So there have now been quite a number of studies, and you and your colleagues published a systematic review that assessed the state of the literature in 2020. I think you published that, and comparing these hydrogels with regular carbohydrate products, both in terms of the performance parameters and metabolic parameters. So can you talk a bit about when you published this meta-analysis, what was the state of evidence in terms of number and quality of studies and the demographics investigated and so on to set the background?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's amazing to think that we published that 2 years ago. Time certainly disappeared into a vacuum in the last 2 years, hasn't it? The literature at the time was relatively scarce when it comes to hydrogels. I certainly would hesitate from calling it a meta-analysis, and even a systematic review might be too generous. We just looked at the 6 studies that had been published at that time and just wanted to see whether there were any similar characteristics between those studies. And typically what we see in exercise nutrition studies, certainly in acute feeding, is a range of protocols, study designs, participants that were used in studies. And that certainly makes initial comparisons quite tricky. And that's pretty much exactly what we found in the six studies that have been published up until February or March 2020. It's not to say that each of the or any of the studies individually was poor. They weren't. They were actually all conducted by good, reputable labs around the world by good quality scientific researchers. I don't have any doubts as to the merits of those studies. It's just that the difference in, say, for example, one was in cross-country skiing, one was in running, and the others were cycling. It makes comparisons potentially hard there. There was a range of different exercise intensities used, a range of exercise durations, training status of participants. So there's a number of factors that I think, certainly from a scientific point of view, or certainly an analytical point of view, to try and capture the literature at any point is challenging. And with the few number of studies, I'm hesitant to draw really firm conclusions. And that hasn't particularly changed since then because of pretty obvious reasons. It's been pretty hard to get in a lab. There have been a couple of other studies published since.
Yeah. So staying with the results of those studies that you reviewed, then without drawing any firm conclusions, can you paint a picture of what the results looked like across those studies in terms of, we can start maybe with performance parameters?
Yeah, in a nutshell, the hydrogel doesn't work, is what we concluded. That none of the studies showed significant performance benefit over typical carbohydrate drinks. That obviously, you can still make the comparison then to control solutions. So typically, control solutions in studies would be water or a flavor-matched sweetened placebo, i.e. it doesn't have any carbohydrate sugar content in it. And that was beneficial, so that the hydrogel wasn't doing any harm compared to traditional sports drinks. It was just matching it.
Yeah, no, that's clear and easy. What about when you look into the metabolic parameters? And can you explain first which ones you tended to look at and then what the results you found were?
I guess the key thing from a mechanistic point of view that we're interested in metabolically is the amount of carbohydrate that the body can use that came from the drink. And we call that exogenous carbohydrate oxidation. So exogenous meaning from outside. And that didn't change. But all out of those six studies, that parameter wasn't measured. I think only one of the studies had measured that and there wasn't any difference. And we're also interested, or certainly within that study, because I think we'll come on to the conversation in a sec around what happens to the endogenous carbohydrate stores, so glycogen within the body. Other things we're interested in looking at is plasma glucose. There weren't any significant differences in that between traditional carbohydrate drinks and the hydrogel. Lactate was unchanged. I wouldn't particularly expect to see changes in lactate if the composition of the sugars was the same. And we also were interested, because of the initial marketing claims around the Morton product, what happened to gastrointestinal distress or symptoms of gastrointestinal distress. And there were a couple of minor differences between the hydrogel and the traditional drink, but the variability reported between the participants and between the studies was too big to sort of lean to any specific conclusions in that regard as well.
Mm. Yeah, coming back to the oxidation of exogenous carbohydrates, that's certainly one of the things that just when you first start thinking about it, the theory or the purported theory and mechanism behind these gels, you would think that, okay, if we can get these gel or these sugars into the intestine quicker and maybe get more of that into the intestine, then you could, in a scenario where you might not get, with regular gels, where you might not get it out into the intestine as quickly, then your body would still theoretically have to rely more on sources of endogenous carbohydrates. And that's why you would hypothesize that, okay, maybe with these hydrogels, we can actually cover more of our carbohydrate needs through the carbohydrates we actually put in our body through the gels themselves rather than taking from our stored carbohydrates in the body. But that's what, these studies anyway that were reviewed, or this study that did review that, did not find any difference. But just to explain the theory behind that. And also interesting to hear about the GI distress symptoms, that there weren't any differences. Since that review, though, you and your lab have published an intervention study of your own where you compared the hydrogels versus standard gels versus placebo as well, and you did that in runners. So what led you to conduct this study? We're trying to basically cover some missing holes in the existing literature?
Yeah, that's quite a good way of putting it, covering a few gaps off. The study you're talking about was published last year and came out, I think, for sort of full access early in 2022. And that was led by Josh Rowe, who was a PhD student in John O'Hara's group up in Leeds in the UK. And Josh ran a great study putting this together. It's not easy kind of getting these acute metabolic studies put together, and running actually throws a few extra challenges into the mix in regards to sample collection and various other things, as well as just asking people to run on a treadmill for 2.5 hours. It's quite different to asking cyclists to do that. I think sort of hitting holes or covering a few holes is quite a good way of putting it. Josh had spent a lot of time in the lab formulating his own hydrogel solution and tried a huge number of prototypes. So we weren't using a commercial product. I don't know whether that's important for people to hear or not, but it was a lab-made product like all of the products that we have used in our research we make ourselves. He'd also looked at a range of different issues, I guess, with regards to gastrointestinal comfort across different exercise intensities to try and sort of hit upon a sweet spot as to what intensity might be most beneficial. I think sort of settled on approximately 70% VO2 max, partly because of the GI issues that he had seen in some pilot work, but partly because that's...
Can you give an idea for the listeners when running at 70% max for a regular amateur athlete? Are we talking about roughly marathon pace or so?
Yeah, I guess for a well-trained amateur athlete, yeah, your sustainable speed for 2 to 3 hours, yeah. As athletes become more trained or more tuned to race faster, they can achieve a higher percentage of their VO2 max for that duration. But yeah, in these runners, we were looking at well-trained amateur athletes. So I think for context, their VO2 max was in and around the 60s.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good. Yeah. So do go on. Sorry for interjecting there.
That's all right. The study was put together as well off the back of some of the research that I'd done earlier looking at dose response of typical carbohydrate ingestion. So we knew we were targeting or looking to try and target about 90 grams an hour of carbohydrate ingestion. That had come from, some of the work I'd done, but a huge body of research that had been done by numerous researchers across the world previously, looking at trying to optimize the dose of exogenous carbohydrate to take. Relatively universal agreement hitting around 90 grams an hour of a mixture of glucose and fructose. We can come back to this a little bit more if you like as well. Was good. So we were trying to keep some consistency in Josh's study with some of that information. Running was important because we know that GI issues are more prevalent in runners. There's been some nice research covering that off. And part of that mechanism is simply just down to the mechanical effort of running. Your gut is mobile and bouncing, whereas when you're sitting on a bike, you tend to be more stationary through the center of your body, and that mechanical dislocation of the gut can cause some issues. And there's potentially some slightly different changes in blood flow as well that cause issues. So we thought we were setting up a pretty good environment to give the hydrogel a chance to work by increasing that exercise intensity slightly compared to the previous studies. Only one of those studies that we reviewed 2 years before had got to a similar exercise intensity, and that was the cross-country skiing study. We wanted to stress duration, so we didn't want to just do a short sort of 1 hour or so protocol. We also wanted to combine the study with a performance test. So that's often one of the challenges of getting people to come in and exercise in the lab for a long time, is often you can choose between looking at a mechanistic study and just fixing the exercise intensity, or doing a performance test. And we've had success with doing both before by adding a short performance test on at the end of a fixed intensity period. So they did 2 hours of running followed by 5K time trial.
Yeah, that's really interesting to combining the two. And is there anything else? We're moving into the protocol then. You already mentioned that the participants were well trained VO2 max in the 60s, and the running the protocol being that 2 hour submaximal run followed by 5K time trial. What other things do we need to know about the methods and the study protocol?
I think that the rest is hopefully relatively straightforward. The drinks were matched for energy and sugar content between the carbohydrate drink and the hydrogel drink. We also had a control solution, so a non-carbohydrate drink within there as well, just for comparison back to having nothing.
Got it. Yeah. So what did you find then? And again, we can maybe start with the performance results in terms of performance.
Yeah. So there was no surprise that the carbohydrate in the drink improved performance. That was not unexpected. We did also see that the hydrogel drink compared to the non-hydrogel drink was about 2% quicker across the 5K time trial as well. And actually almost all of the, well, seven of the participants got quicker, and a couple, they were marginally slower, but certainly no one regressed backwards significantly between going from the normal carbohydrate drink to the hydrogel.
Mm. And why do you think that that this was the case? Is it really a combination of the factors you mentioned there, longer duration, slightly higher intensity early on, running? Are those the reasons that you found that difference between hydrogel and non-hydrogel carbohydrates?
I think when you start to make the comparisons to the study design, it gets quite tricky to nut out exactly what change or difference might or might not cause a difference. And I think that's why I'm always keen to stress the need for lots of information before we sort of start making clear-cut recommendations. And yeah, this is one study in the jigsaw that shows that there's potentially some benefit. I think probably the key parameter was just nudging that exercise intensity up higher. We know that splenic blood flow is reduced, so blood flow to the gut area is lower during higher intensity exercise. You will have felt that yourself if you race really hard or a shorter, harder race. It's much harder to eat or drink anything and keep it down in a comfortable way than if you're kind of out for a long, steady, cruisy training ride. And I think, yeah, a combination with the running element as well. And that maybe was just enough to reduce some GI symptoms, which we saw a reduction in GI distress just slightly. That was maybe enough to indicate that there was better comfort and better handling of the carbohydrate. And the study also showed this sort of slight increase, which was significant statistically, in the exogenous oxidation from the hydrogel.
Mm, yeah, that's really interesting. How many participants did you have in the study and in each group?
So it's a repeated measures design. So that means that everyone did each of the conditions, i.e. the placebo condition, the normal carbohydrate drink, and the hydrogel drink, every person did each of those conditions, yep. And we had 11 people. Yep.
Okay, got it. So what about other studies that have been released since the review that you conducted, in addition to this one that you were involved in? Have there been any other interesting new knowledge, interesting new studies that would be important to hear about?
There's a guy called Sean Suithall who's publishing as well in this area. He put a paper out in 2021, which looked at aid endurance runners. Again, they were well trained as well. Their VO2max was in and around 70, and they looked at exogenous oxidation. I think the dose was slightly lower in that. So it was about 70 grams an hour of a mixture of glucose and fructose. And they didn't see any significant difference in the oxidation from the hydrogel and the normal carbohydrate drink. But when they also did a single hydrogel dose at a higher rate, and that did increase exogenous oxidation. The only challenge with that study was, from memory, they didn't have a comparison carbohydrate condition in that higher dose. And so I would kind of expect the exogenous oxidation to have gone up simply because the carbohydrate was higher, not necessarily because of the hydrogel.
Yeah. And if we start to try to summarize this and give some practical applied tips for listeners, then what would you recommend as a practitioner regarding the use or not use of hydrogels to the listeners?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And ultimately, there's no point in doing these lab studies if it doesn't translate out into the real world and helping runners, cyclists, even swimmers, triathletes, doing all of them, to use something. And I think I'm still definitely happy with the idea of hydrogels. I think there's mileage in this from a scientific sense, and I definitely think there's mileage in it from a practical sense for people to use. I think I probably wouldn't rush out and buy it tomorrow as the kind of thing that's going to change your race day. I think there are a lot of factors that are going to override your performance on race day, a lot of them nutrition related as well. But I still think if it works for you and you're happy with it and it sits well in your gut and in your stomach and you feel that you get some reduced symptoms of GI distress or you think that you get that extra lift from it, go for it. I think you've just got to go out and experiment and try it yourself sometimes and not rely too much on what the labs are doing.
Yeah, no, I would 100% agree with that. As a coach, I've had a couple of athletes that have struggled with nutrition before and with GI distress symptoms before, and then they've tried some hydrogel products, and it's basically like magic solved all of their GI issues. So at an individual level, I've seen that it can have a big difference and a big impact.
Yeah.
on the athletes, even though as an average or a population level, maybe the difference isn't really there, or we're not really clear on what conditions there need to be for the difference to be there.
It's
worth experimenting if you have issues.
I think it's worth experimenting if you do know you are prone to GI discomfort when you exercise. I think it's worth a go. From my experience, maybe kind of 5 to 10% of people will have an intolerance to fructose. It's not hereditary fructose intolerance. That's a very different medical condition. But I think if you know that you struggle with fructose, so fructose is the kind of sugar you find in fruit predominantly. If you have any sort of bloating type reactions or stomach cramps when you eat a lot of fruit, you potentially might be indicative of having a slight intolerance to fructose, or you just take carbohydrate drinks and gels when you exercise that have a fructose component to them and you feel GI issues, fructose could well be the source of those. And the hydrogel could be one way of helping just get that carbohydrate delivered through the stomach that little bit quicker, into the intestine a little bit quicker, without that kind of feedback and through the gut that's causing those issues. I'd probably add that if your carb ingestion during exercise is so low, you know, 20, 30 grams an hour, i.e. one gel, you know, is approximately 20 to 30 grams. It differs between each product, doesn't it? But if that's what you take, you probably don't need fructose in the first place. So going to a Morton hydrogel is probably not the way you necessarily need to go. It's more expensive for a start. Maybe just experiment with the composition of what is actually in the sugars that you're taking.
Yeah. Yeah, and just to clarify that, so for the listeners, the benefit of having fructose in addition to glucose in a gel or a carbohydrate product is that you can saturate the carbohydrate transporters, and there's only so much glucose that can be transported across the intestine and to the muscles. So, but when you have fructose, you use different transporters, so you can get an additional. And traditionally, the numbers that we've seen is that approximately 60 grams per hour of glucose and 30 grams per hour of fructose. So instead of being limited to being able to actually take up 60 grams, you can take up 90 grams theoretically. And we'll get into some questions about that and maybe stretching the limits. But then the potential there with hydrogels would then be, as you say, that if you can just get them through the stomach in a kind of smuggled, as you say, in that hydrogel format, then maybe you won't have the issues, but you can still benefit from having that multiple transportable carbohydrate source of energy.
Yeah, couldn't put it better myself.
So yeah, that's actually where I wanted to go next with glucose and fructose, and let's talk a little bit about the ratios. So as I said, the 2-to-1 ratio has been commonly used, but there are now some products, and I can't remember, is Morton one of them that uses a 1-to-0.8 ratio of glucose to fructose? And then my question really is, what do you think, how much evidence is there for one potentially being better than the other or being quote-unquote optimal?
Yeah, it's definitely a tiny bit complicated, this one. I think my advice would kind of come first on this, which is, and similar to the hydrogel advice, is go out and see what works for you. Don't necessarily take a product or a lab study or an advert or article that you've seen and go and think that that's just going to work. I think when it comes to glucose, it's a bit more simple and straightforward. The upper limit for absorption across the intestine is around 1 to 1.2 grams per minute. So that's roughly 60 to 70 grams per hour. You can do the maths on how much is in each gel or drink and how often you take it during your exercise. Fructose, I think, is a little bit more nuanced, just partially because of what I mentioned before about that individual difference and tolerability to fructose. It certainly seems to be more of the source of GI issues. And so if you think you fall in that camp, or you're going to set about going out and trying fructose in your gels and your drinks, just start low and build it up and just see what you can get to. The evidence behind the ratio of fructose to glucose is a bit mixed as well. There's some really, really excellent studies that were done between roughly 2005 to 2015, largely by a guy called David Rowlands, but the few other contributors like Wendy O'Brien and Gareth Wallace, who did some really, really good, nifty studies in this area. And their kind of conclusion was that a ratio of 0.8 to 1, so fructose to glucose, so a little bit more glucose than fructose, was best. But then the kind of recommendations that have come off that, sort of go back towards kind of 0.5 to 1, so half the amount of fructose to glucose. And I think we're seeing definitely an effect of different studies happening there, so different people in different studies, different protocols, different feeding patterns that affect that. And it's sort of, I think I'd just caution people from getting too fixated on what's probably quite a small number, 0.8, 0.7, 0.5 to 1. You know, we're talking grams of fructose. That's different. We're not going to suddenly be producing all these mega moles of ATP production at the muscle just because we've tweaked that ratio significantly. I think once you're pushing that total carbohydrate intake up above 60 grams per hour, put fructose in and play around with that ratio. Start at approximately 0.4 to 1. So if you've got 60 grams of glucose, you know, go just under 30 grams of fructose and just start building it and just see what you can get to. There's also research that looks at sucrose. So that's table sugar. There's a mixture of 1 to 1 of glucose and fructose. And that works. You know, you might not get the optimum number in terms of exogenous carbohydrate oxidation, but if I said, do you want 1.3 grams a minute of exogenous carbohydrate oxidation or 1.22 grams per minute, you're going to be picky over the difference.
Yeah, that's good. That's all good advice. First of all, it's very, very practical, and it does make some sense to start lower and then just try to work your way up, but equally not being fixated on the differences are relatively small in the grand scheme of things, with whether you go at a 2 to 1 or a 1 to 0.8 ratio. But the studies that we have seen coming out in recent years about going to higher total amounts of carbohydrate, like going up to 120 grams per hour, what do you think of those? In what scenarios I've interviewed Aitor Virbay about this, where they did some studies in mountain runners and they saw some positive effects of that. But what they didn't do, obviously, because that was a field study, not a lab study, they didn't look at things like actual carbohydrate oxidation or exogenous carbohydrate oxidation. What's your take on going to these higher amounts, which in applied practice seems to be becoming more and more popular and prevalent?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there that it's, at the moment, it's coming from the field. Aitor is a great practitioner. I've had communications with him and love what he's doing. He's a great communicator in science, and him and several others. And if you talk to people in the pro cycling world, you know, these athletes are consuming staggering amounts of carbohydrate. I just kind of can't visualize it sometimes, like how much they're taking on the bike, how much they eat in their diet, you know, over big races and big training blocks. It's huge intake. I think we have to moderate the advice between these athletes at the very, very top, you know, 0.1% of the field and the rest of us, to some extent. I think the 120 grams an hour work has got a lot of mileage in it. I think we should be trying to push the limit of what we can get people to take. I think from the studies you refer to, that were done in the field, they were ultra running studies, and they looked at some interesting measures around recovery, neuromuscular performance and recovery, and they showed that the high dose, that 120 grams an hour, was beneficial. They admitted that potentially in a training context that could potentially be harmful, that it might slightly blunt the adaptive response. So I think that's an interesting thing we need to bear in mind. I think the likelihood is that the people that could tolerate that high dose had had exposure to using and taking carbohydrate before as well. And that's certainly what, if you speak to people in the pro sport world that getting that training of the gut is probably quite a key parameter to be able to push that 90 gram an hour recommendation much higher.
Yeah. I think that you hit the nail on the head there with a couple of the points there. First of all, it being ultra running, and I think that's, as a triathlon coach, and most of my athletes focus on half and full distance triathlon. So that those events taking between 4 hours to 17 hours from the fast end of half distance to slow end of full distance, that's obviously, you're just going to, by the sheer amount of time that it takes you, you're going to gradually just deplete your carbohydrate stores so much that if you can take on more, then that will delay the point where you are too depleted to, well, where you actually lose performance, or worst case scenario, really get into a bonking situation. So that's one interesting aspect of it. But I think it's interesting what you mentioned there with the training, whether in training, if you habitually do that, if you blunt the adaptive response. On the other hand, I wouldn't recommend anybody to never train with the amount that they're going to use on race day. You kind of need to make sure that you can tolerate it at least on a few training occasions before you decided, okay, this is my plan for race day.
Yeah, you just can't go out and try something for the first time. You wouldn't rock up on race day with a brand new pair of runners, would you?
No, unless, well, actually, I would.
Would you?
With the new Nike shoes. But I mean, not the first time I used them. I did practice in them in training a few times before the race. But since then, I'm actually just saving them for race day. And the next time I
buy rip the tags off
of them, I'll
in transition.
Yeah, exactly. Now, maybe that's also an exaggeration now, because now we're getting more information from some interesting case study data that they actually have more mileage in them without reduced performance than we initially thought when it was thought that after 200 kilometers, those shoes are done. So maybe I would change my approach on that as well.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, they'll last a bit longer than wanting you to buy the next pair.
Yeah. All right, so we got through the point on training the gut as well, which you mentioned that you probably need to do that to be able to consume those high amounts. Then one question that I also had is, we discussed hydrogels and how they compare to regular gels. What about other sources of carbohydrate, like sports drinks, bars, and even like Haribo or Snickers, like all sorts of things that you see people use? What do you think about how those types of products compare?
Yeah, I mean, Graham O'Bry, famous Scottish cyclist, used to eat jam sandwiches. He wouldn't do anything else, maybe a banana. I think there's a role definitely for finding a food stuff that works for you. At the end of the day, I'm a believer from a nutritional point of view in what food does as a reward system to your brain, and food is inextricably linked to mood and satisfaction, isn't it, as well? So if chugging down endless gels, which are sometimes quite rich and sticky, is not for you, and you want some Haribo or some Jelly Babies, do it. Like, the composition first, you know, adding that little bit extra into your diet or on your training rides or runs, it's going to be pretty much good enough. Most of them made with a mixture of glucose syrup or glucose and some table sugar, sucrose, so you're probably getting a good blend of glucose and fructose. It's nice, isn't it? From a metabolic point of view, I'm not aware of any evidence, and there's definitely studies to show that there isn't really any difference between really high sugar sweets or lollies and off-the-shelf special sports nutrition products. So if you find that a particular bag of sweets works best for you and you like the taste, go for it. You might find that the chewiness of them or the kind of gelatinous component maybe would increase any GI issues if you're prone to that. So again, comes back to trial and error and practicing that on training sessions and not on race day. But yeah, it definitely works. And if you're out for really long sessions on the bike, for example, you might want something that's a bit more whole food, you know, hence the jam sandwich or the high carbohydrate bar. Rice cakes are great. You can use rice cakes as well to break up the sweetness and have something a bit more savory as well. So you're changing up the flavor profile of what you're eating.
Yeah. Obviously, in a long endurance run, it doesn't really make a difference if it's maybe a bit slower, but I'm just imagining that potentially it takes a bit longer for bars or Haribo or something to, you know, get out into intestine and be able to take it up by the muscles. Is that something that you're aware of mechanistically that actually happens, or is that just a pure speculation that it would take longer for it to get into the system properly?
No, if you have food with a content of protein and fat with it as well, it will slow down the whole process of digestion. It takes you longer to chew it. It takes longer for the stomach acid to break it into something that can pass into the intestine. It takes longer for the intestine to break down enzymatically the components of those food and release it into the bloodstream. All of that delay, yeah, is potentially something that could lead towards increasing your GI distress. But if you have a low enough content and just drip feed it in, or it's something that's much more simple to eat, you know, rice cakes, again, great example, because it's pretty much just rice with maybe a bit of binding agent of some sort. Try it and you shouldn't experience too many issues. If you're going to go and stop for a massive sandwich by the side of the road or a pizza, you know, don't be surprised that when you pull off again and get riding that you're going to have some issues. You know, it's an extreme example, yeah, to kind of demonstrate the more whole food you put in, yeah, the more potential issue you might be opening yourself up to.
Yeah, and maybe on race day, everybody's individual there, but on race day it might be a bit recommended to use the traditional faster proper sports nutrition products like the gels and the sports drinks because the intensity is higher, so you're working closer to your capacity and you might be more sensitive if you have slower gastric emptying as well or slower digestion with something like a bar or a pizza in your back pocket. Yeah. So yeah, there might be a difference there between racing and the long steady ride or run.
Yeah, potentially. And again, that's just for each person to come out to what they're most comfortable with. At the same time, obviously trying to bear in mind that you're performing and that race is a performance that you want to try and get the maximum fuel delivery there you can, if that's your strategy.
Yeah. And well, that kind of is maybe part of the answer already to my next question, which is that especially for athletes training at higher volumes and they do need to fuel with a large amount of carbohydrate for their training, but they don't necessarily want to spend huge amounts of money on having all of that be gels or other sports nutrition products. What would be your tips or hacks potentially of what good, cheap replacements for those gels would be?
Yeah, you can make your own sports drinks up. Most people, especially if you're into baking or home cooking at all, you're going to have sugar lying around at home. So just weigh some sugar into your water bottle and add water. Bear in mind that table sugar or sugar as you're going to buy it in the bags from the supermarket is sucrose. So that is a one-to-one ratio of fructose and glucose. So don't just sort of go sticking it in thinking it's glucose, but you can get glucose in powder form from the pharmacy or online. It's pretty cheap. Make up your own. Same with fructose. You know, people making jam, for example, will buy fructose. You can get that from the shop. So you can just experiment with making your own drinks and just weigh that out. You can experiment with making it super concentrated, so use less water. You might want to make it more dilute, use more water. Challenge with drinks, obviously, is you've got to carry them, isn't it? So easier for cycling than for running, unless you've got a run loop that you're doing a particular session. You might be doing laps of the local lake or something, and you can just leave a stash of bottles somewhere and have those laid out and ready for you. And you touched on it before, like you can just buy sweets and stuff in bags ready to go. That works. Put a jam sandwich in your back pocket. The other thing I think that answers that question is maybe diet as well. And we haven't sort of talked a lot about diet today, but, you know, good, high quality food to support the training that you're doing. You know, you touched on volume there, is just fueling for the block of work that you're doing. So like thinking about the period of training that you're in and what you want your diet to do, and good wholesome sources of carbohydrate like potatoes and rice. They add a lot of carbohydrate content to your diet. They're healthy, and you can actually, I mean, you like I said, you can also use those to make on the bike running snacks as well. So yeah, between those, I think it's achievable at home, and then you can just supplement with the specialist products as and when you need them.
Yeah. I find that for cycling, it's very easy, as you say, to make your own mixes. And then for running, you might not even do that many long runs. As a triathlete anyway, you might do one long run per week where maybe one intense run where you might have something. But then even if you use a gel or two for that intense run and a few more gels for that long run, then if you can, on the bike, save money by just making your own mixes, then that's also a solution where you will save a lot compared to using all gels all the time, even on the bike. And and gets around that problem of it being difficult to carry things on the run, because gels are easy to carry. All right, and just starting to wrap up here, what are the current projects that you're working on?
So the group over here is still looking into numerous supplements for performance. So that's Louise Burke's group at ACU and the AIS over here in Australia. There's projects we're interested in exploring the hydrogel work further. I know that John O'Hara, former colleague, has got a study coming up in the hydrogel world, which will be very interesting. And that's, I think there's still work to be done, sort of just trying to nut out some of the fueling strategies that we can use for exercise. Our group has published recently on ketone ingestion, for example, during exercise. And I've got a project running at the minute with the guys in Oxford looking at ketone ingestion during simulated triathlon. So we're sort of playing around with the dose of ketones and dose of carbohydrates and doing a pretty hard protocol of about an hour hard on the bike. I've done it. It was awful. and then straight off the bike and onto the treadmill for a 10K. So, yeah, that's a study in progress as well. Hopefully wrap up this year and get it to print, fingers crossed, in the next 6 to 12 months.
Cool. And where can the listeners follow you if they want to keep up with that? Twitter, ResearchGate, any other?
I'm on ResearchGate. There's stuff on there. I think that's pretty up to date. But Twitter's usually the best spot, especially if people want to reach out about anything. Andy J. King.
Yeah, perfect. Let's finish up with the rapid fire questions. So take just one sentence to answer each of these. And the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource related to endurance sports?
Yeah, I'm slightly left field here. Ranulph Fiennes' autobiography. Fiennes was an explorer in the kind of 70s and 80s, and just sheer unbelievable efforts of willpower, round the globe type exploration. Incredible.
Yeah, I can second that. I think he has many books, but I have one of them here in the bookshelf behind me. Really good. What's an important habit that you've benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
Oh, to cover all three, sorting out my sleep, getting a good sleep routine going, really, makes a massive difference.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And who's somebody you look up to or that has inspired you?
Both of my granddads, they fought or serviced armed forces in World War II. And for me, they represent the sacrifice of a generation that influenced my upbringing. They never asked for, wanted, for anything themselves over anyone else. And that's a thing that I try and fail to live up to.
All right. Finally, thank you so much, Andy. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for sharing your knowledge, and hope to talk to you again soon.
More than welcome. Thanks so much for having me here.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com with links to Andy's profiles on Twitter and ResearchGate, as well as the studies that we mentioned. So you can have a look at them. They are open access on ResearchGate, so you will have links to the full articles. Now, if you want to improve your triathlon performance and want some help to achieve your goals, then consider working with a scientific triathlon coach or a scientific triathlon training plan. Whether you're just getting into triathlon, trying to qualify for a world championship event, or even want to race professionally, we have experience in all of those scenarios and would love to discuss further around if and how we can help you on your triathlon journey. Find out more and contact us on scientifictriathlon.com, and we can discuss your specific goals and needs and see what's best for you. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Use their free online sweat test and quick carb calculator to understand your fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs and individualize your plan. Also, book a free video consultation with the team at Precision Fuel and Hydration to get help with refining your strategy. Use the code TTS22 at checkout for 15% off your first order of fueling and hydration products. And thank you to Zen8. Use the Zen8 swim trainer to improve your technique, power, stamina, and most importantly, your swim training consistency. Get 20% off your order on the swim trainer with the promo code that you can get on zen8swimtrainer.com/TTS. And don't forget that it's a risk-free investment. If you don't love it after 2 weeks, send it back and you'll get a full refund. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.